Invest, I'm Pip Rasmussen, and today we're talking about play. How it's never outside anymore, and young whippersnappers these days spend too much time on the iPad and Facebook. Here's Cass Wilkinson, who's thought about the concept of play as a mum and an author.
I have a little book that I wrote called The Kids Are All Right, which I wrote in order to try to put a few facts together about some of the things that make people afraid of letting their kids play more.
How have things changed between when you were a kid then and now?
Lots of things have changed since I was a kid, except kids. So grown-ups have changed in their attitudes to kids, probably best exemplified by the number of schools that have banned running and chasing games, cartwheels, handstands, British Bulldog, Red Rover.
Bull Rush? I really missed that one in primary school when they banned that.
Yeah, and you know, even if some of us can remember the gnarly brandings of British Bulldog and maybe have some sympathy, I think banning games like tag is taking it much too far. I suppose the difference is that when kids acted like kids, when I was a little kid, grown-ups weren't surprised and they didn't get involved. And generally speaking, if there were no broken bones or not too much bleeding, you're expected to just pull yourself together and push on. Now there's much more of an effort to prevent bad things ever happening to kids. And the difficulty with this is that some of that rough and tumble is actually developmentally useful for kids, and some of it's just a lot of fun for kids. And when we put too many restrictions on them, not only are we making childhood a lot less fun, but we're also stopping them from learning a lot of the skills they need for when they're not kids anymore and they're grown-ups.
How do you reckon that kind of change in society actually started? I'm just wondering, like, how did people begin to go, actually, let's pull back these kids from, like, learning this rough and tumble way and kind of chin up, move on? Like, I'm just wondering, how did that begin?
I think there's a lot of reasons for it. You know, a million books on the topic, but some of it has to do with the rising awareness of crimes against kids. Some of that's overreactions in the media, but some of it is us being more aware of bad things that do happen. But of course, we have a tendency to overestimate the numbers of them. Child deaths, pedophile scares obviously have become a much bigger concern than they were when I was little, although the numbers of those kinds of attacks haven't gone up at all and they remain very, very rare events. I don't judge anyone who wants to keep their kids as safe as they can all the time. But it is important to remember that when horrible things happen to kids, that is very rare. Most of the horrible things that happen to kids are medical events. You know, little kids are much more likely to die from cancer and congenital diseases. And essentially, when you look at the causes of death for kids, they've been going down from all causes, from medical causes, from injury causes, criminal causes. Certainly kids are safer than they were when I was small. And when I was small, we were safer than when my grandparents were small. So it's a change in attitudes. And partly it's to do with rising incomes and prosperity as well. You know, when I was small, parents were too busy. And certainly social attitudes were different. It was expected that kids would break bones from time to time, that kids would hang out with other kids, that they didn't need to be supervised by adults who were probably too busy working, doing housework, things that have all become, I guess, you know, these days we've made, oddly, after women making all of their strides to get into the workforce, we've now required women to supervise their kids more than we used to in the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, there's some interesting writing on the topic by women who see the overregulation of kids as being, in a way, another form of keeping women in the household space as well. But, you know, the fact is there's a million causes for all of this, but probably a good time for us to stop some of it. And it does surprise me that we spend half the time in the debate about kids talking about how they're all getting too fat and they don't get enough exercise and they're at risk getting type 2 diabetes, and on the other hand, constantly giving them fewer opportunities to play. And I guess a good case of this is kids used to go to the park by themselves. You know, when I was little, kids would go to the park without their parents all the time. Now, it's generally considered neglectful of parents to let their children go unsupervised out of doors.
Hmm.
Parents are pretty lazy about going to the park, so if kids can only go when their parents want to go, it means A, they can't go between the end of school and the end of work, and B, they have to go when their parents feel like it. So kids become, you know, kids who would naturally be out having a great time and running around and exercising all the time, you know, their natural instincts for healthy play have been curbed by parental preferences. And when you look at the danger of letting your kids walk down the street and go to the park and play, they're actually far less at risk of having a bad event happen to them down at the local park than they are at risk of getting type 2 diabetes because they don't get any exercise.
We took a look at people trying to resist this trend of play being more and more commercialised. So it makes sense to start with the man who first got us interested in the topic. Jim Wooten is 86 and owned a toy shop in Melbourne's southeast for 50 years. It closed in February this year, and Bethany Atkinson Quinton visited before he closed the doors for the last time.
The only thing seriously worth considering is what happens when the toy gets into the hands of the child. Its saleability and all those factors are secondary to the fact that it must be useful, attractive, encouraging to play with, and preferably, if possible, stimulating to the imagination. I think I'm more determined than ever that kids need what somebody called slow toys, but it's not my term, but it describes quite well, I think, the sort of thing that a child will take up and play with in the way that their own imagination guides them, even if it's the simplest thing with a very young child pushing a truck across.
My name is Jim Wooten. I was the founder with my wife of Boy and Girl Toy Shop in 1965, which has lasted until the end of February this year when it will close.
Reluctantly.
Jim's retiring. He's 86 years old. We're in his toy shop. It is rich in charm with every aspect of the small shop being well thought through.
Designed like this so that you can put toys on this low shelf that kids can interact with.
The bottom shelves stand at a height that is accessible for the young children to pick up and interact with the toys.
And if anything is pulled off and breaks on the floor, then it shouldn't have been there. It won't be again.
You can see how important this shop is to him and his wife. He takes me out the back to his office. Jim has always believed that children should be the driver of their own imagination and that all great toys should facilitate that exploration. That relationship between child and toy has definitely changed since they first began running Boy and Girl. Jim blames the commercialisation of play.
Kids tend to have a lot of toys, but a lot of them are not up to much, and they are often broken easily, and we have a lot of mothers complaining about the fact that their kids are given a lot of toys that of a kind that they would never buy for them, and that the kids end up sort of wading ankle deep through broken toys. One mother I talked to a while ago pointed it up by saying that she goes round from time to time with a plastic bag and a shovel and brush and just shovels up a few shovelfuls and puts them in the plastic bag to reduce the clutter. And she said, I've never had a complaint. The children have never missed what she's swept away.
So how do we get to a point where we have children wading ankle deep in toys? We're now living in a world where we can access information at our fingertips at any hour of the day or night. So maybe we, as humans, are losing the attention span to sit with a well-made object and just explore. Because we know that at any point we could seek out a new experience, a new piece of information, a new toy.
The world around them has changed more than the people have changed. it might be, you know, I get a skewed view of this because my customers, because they're my customers, tend to be the sort of people who prefer their children to be playing with traditional toys than contributing to the what Professor Greenfield calls the flickering image, by which she means the iPads and phones, clever phones, and television and computers. And not only children, but particularly young adults, but many adults these days are also very, very much committed to watching the screen.
The toy industry's relationship with the toy has also been changing. A toy can't be too small to swallow. It can't be too sharp. Regulations have changed since Jim first set up shop.
Tin toys now are almost always classified for either classified not as toys at all. By this I mean tin cars that you wind up, that sort of toy. Because the standards are so rigid about control of the edges and so forth. But, you know, I think you learn from tin toys that metal edges are sharp and you should be aware of them because you've got either that or you'll cut your hand much more severely on the lid of a tin or something that is about us all the time.
As a young kid, I remember that every trip to my grandma's house was like a super special covert mission. My sister and I would sneak into her back room that was laced in old clothes and magazines. The room had vibrant royal blue carpet and became the water in which we would fish out my grandma's fluoro pink and green fishnet stockings. We would pretend to cook them in her spare frying pan and then sell them to each other in our shops that we made out of clothes forts. So, like Jim believes, the value of a toy can come just from the power of a child's imagination.
Children who have got sand, earth and water are not without toys. They are three of the best toys, none of which we sell. But if most people think back in to their childhood, they'll recall something like that as being one of their favourite things. You never see a bored child on the beach. This was sort of old-fashioned. It was a replica of an old...
As Jim takes me around the shop, he shares with me some of his favourite pieces. He speaks with a pride that you can feel. Jim shuts up shop next week, after 50 years. And even though the toys will leave him, he will never relinquish the joy of watching a child explore the world.
I will miss the customers greatly. I'll miss watching the kids in the shop, which I've always enjoyed. Particularly as I've got older, as I've got to grandfather age, I sort of look at the children much more indulgently and much more... with much more sort of delight and amazement that they're just so marvellous and curious and inquiring and reaching out from the pram where the mothers can't quite see that think they've parked them so that they can't read something. Something goes crash. I find myself now if I see a child sort of leaning out and trying to get something, I stand at the counter thinking, go on, try again. You're needy there. Go on.
That was Jim Wooten speaking with our producer Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Jim got us thinking about the commercialization of play more generally. They used to be just toys, like trucks, teddy bears, and spinning tops. But now there are aisles full of branded merchandise for films and video games. They used to be play experiences that were cheap, or even free. But now they come at a premium. Here's Cass Wilkinson again.
I'm always amazed at how often I see that climbing trees is a thing that you can pay to do now, properly supervised.
What is that? I actually don't know what that is.
You can go to places. Well, in fact, Taronga Zoo has one now, and there's one towards the Central Coast, where you can climb trees in a properly supervised environment. In their defense, they have awesome rope bridges and things too.
Okay.
But it's basically climbing trees with helmets and supervision. You can go and jump on trampolines with, you know, properly safety supervised trampolines in a big building full of trampolines.
And someone who got trained to just stand there.
That's right. Properly trained staff. Indoor playgrounds with no risk of getting sunburnt or falling over. And, you know, the amount of experiences which used to be free, which used to be fully accessible for kids by themselves, which have been turned not only into places where adults watch all the time, but where people have to pay. So we're taking things that we used to do in a very casual way and for free and turning them into organised, supervised and commercialised activities. And that seems to me to be both unnecessary and expensive when we could just be letting our kids get out and head down the park and play by themselves more often.
But as with the commercialisation of anything, there's always resistance. And in this case, a lot of it is coming from concerned parents. Parents who look at the childhood of their kids and can only see how different it is from their own. Cass knew a bit about this. Even after writing her book, she still had to decide how to raise her own kids.
That's one of the most important things for me, is that time that kids spend unsupervised.
And making memories. It sounds so cliche, but it's so true.
But it's true. You know, my greatest childhood memories are of all of those times when, you know, you made a boat to go and sail across a dam in a place where you weren't meant to be in the first place. Mm. Or, you know, where my daughter came home recently and she and her friend had got the wrong bus. So for the first time in their lives, they wound up on the wrong bus in a suburb they didn't know. They had to find out where they were. They had to work out how to get a bus home again. It's those kinds of experiences of finding yourself in an unfamiliar place, having to problem solve by yourself, working out how to make some more grown-up choices and take some responsibility. Those developmental experiences happen when you're unsupervised, when you're just with other kids. And kids, generally speaking, are not being given those opportunities to sort out their own problems. You make decisions for themselves. And I think that is probably the most important thing that's being lost.
And it's not just the kids' welfare that has to be weighed up. There's another factor at stake.
When I was a kid, I lived across the road from a beach called Nobby's. I would sit on the rocks for hours and hours and pretend that the crabs and starfish and anemones were Pokemon and try to catch them all. I'd climb trees with branches so pliable that they probably shouldn't have been climbed. I'd poke sticks under the edges of rock pools to check for blue-ring octopus before sticking my toes in the water. Something I still do today. I've always suspected that the interest I have in the environment was somehow related to the days spent on those rocks. But only recently have I realised how connected they were. In fact, there's a whole raft of research being done on the impact of whole childhoods moving indoors. It could have ramifications for the connections those kids have with the environment when they grow up to be adults. For a grown-up to care about issues like pollution, climate change, logging, mining, biodiversity, they first have to care about nature. And this is something which many researchers believe starts with play, as a child. In 2011, Planet Ark released a study called Climbing Trees, Getting Aussie Kids Back Outdoors. The findings showed a dramatic intergenerational shift when it comes to nature play. 73% of respondents played outdoors more often than indoors when they were young, compared to only 13% of their children. 64% of people who responded said they climbed trees as kids, something that less than 20% of their kids do today. Things have changed, which is not to say the parents of today aren't concerned.
You know, parents work longer hours and more, so there's less time, I guess, with the children to, you know, to spend time with the kids and sort of be around when they play outside.
This is Cecile Vandenberg. She's one of the organisers of Nature Play Week.
There are a lot more fears, and I think it's a lot harder for some parents to let kids play by themselves because the culture has changed a bit too. You know, when I was a kid, the streets were full of children, really. But if I cycle home now, I don't hardly see any children playing outside. I see them walking home from school, but I don't really see them playing in the park.
This year in April, the Kids in Nature Network ran Nature Play Week, a celebration of events that aim to get children outside to interact with the environment. they partnered with places like the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne and Cranbourne and were supported by the Victorian Department of Health and Human Services, as well as local bush kinders and playgroups, to run a whole heap of events throughout the state and even in Sydney.
88 events over the week. You know, we had small playgroups involved, so just parents with children who visited their local park. So really low-key events where they just said, okay, it's Nature Play Week, let's really spend some time in nature this week. To big events staged by government departments like Parks Victoria and their partner Active in Parks. So they had two major events in the national park where children could come with their parents and they had a family nature day. We had kids learning to surf, you know, on Phillip Island, one of the YMCAs. There were lots of activities at the zoo. They had a corroboree, you know, learning about the Aboriginal culture. There was Muddy Boots and Sandy Hands. That's a family nature play group in Geelong. They had a really muddy day. They had nature play in their local parklands, and they actually got out into the lake, into the mud. It was such a diverse week, really, and I think they loved the fact that they could be part of a local community event. You know, going out by yourself is really nice, but it's much nicer even if, you know, you have a local organisation or a group to connect with.
The Kids in Nature Network was born at a conference for young sustainability leaders. They were trying to think of ways to get people to reconnect with nature, to care about what happens to it.
I got together with Dr. Dimity Williams and community development worker Sana Deswart and myself. I'm a human geographer. And we connected because we all thought that was a really important
issue.
The
team came up with an idea which would see decision makers, business leaders, politicians, be reconnected with nature. All the ideas at the conference were voted on to see which was the best. And when all the votes were counted, theirs came last. No one thought reconnecting decision makers with nature could work. So the team started thinking about why they connected with nature. Why did they care so much? It came back to stories and experiences from when they were little kids.
When I was very small, my parents took me to the beach and to the dunes in Holland, or in the Netherlands, where I live.
And the Kids in Nature Network was born.
And when I was about seven, I moved to Belgium, and we moved to a place where we had this amazing forest at the back of our house. And it's funny, when you revisit it when you're older, it's only a small patch of bush, really. But to me, it was this massive forest, and I spent most of my free time outside just chasing the local wildlife around. And that was amazing. So that definitely, I still have a diary. Like I wrote about the birds I saw and what, you know, gave them names. And I wrote what they were doing and all of that. And I found that back recently. It's quite funny. Like a diary of wildlife.
It wasn't the decision makers of today that needed connecting with nature. It was the decision makers of the future. Kids like Otto.
How old are you, Otto?
Three.
Four.
Four.
Four?
Yeah.
And what are you making today?
A bush cubby house.
A bush cubby house? How do you make a bush cubby house?
With trees.
And what kind of trees have you found?
Lots of big trees.
Some of our producers went along to Nature Play Week to meet with the kids and parents. Carly is at Ceres, a community environment park in Melbourne's north. Kids are making bush cubbies, taking bark and sticks and leaves and turning them into little houses.
Can you tell me what your name is and what you do here?
Okay, so my name's Lindy and I'm a volunteer at Ceres. I help out with an area called their Adventure Habitat, which is an area where kids can play and explore nature, and there's a few structures that have been built that are environmentally friendly as well. But we're here today building bush cubbies for Nature Play Week.
What inspired the Cubby House initiative?
This is the second year that we've done cubbies for Nature Play Week with Ceres, and it's really, I guess, in an urban environment, kids don't get a lot of opportunities to build structures with prunings and things like that anymore. So Ceres is a wonderful area that has lots of space and lots of prunings. So we thought, oh, what a great way to allow kids to really get at one with nature and have that opportunity to build and create and use all those skills that sometimes they don't get an opportunity to do.
And what do you see in the children when they're building their cubby houses that might be, I don't know if you have children, but that might be different from playing indoors?
I think the beautiful thing about playing in nature is that it allows open-ended play. they can build and grow.
And how about soft leaves inside?
Soft leaves inside, great idea.
Go in and see how it feels.
Okay, are they soft? So obvious what you make of something at home, or even at the playground where you've got a slide or a swing. I mean, they'll make day-to-day life out of out of different structures, like the good old grocery store out of a just little wooden window. But I find when they're out in this space, they're just able to let their imaginations run so much more wild.
Emma Kewen went to another event, this time at the Royal Botanic Gardens in the heart of Melbourne. It was a mini family nature connection retreat.
Can you tell me about the fire today?
I'm just lighting a fire.
You're lighting it? How are you doing it?
Good.
You've done it already. You have it all
look
sorted.
Look at the leaves.
I know, you've put leaves on it. Does that make it burn faster?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you had fun today?
Yeah.
What have you been doing?
I play with Dicko and make cubby house.
Could you fit inside of it?
Yes, I can.
Yeah? Do you think that you'll move into the cubby house now? Live there?
Yeah.
And playing outside is important for children's health and development. Having creative play outside encourages them to stay longer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're interested in this event.
Do you worry a bit that she's obsessed with fire now?
No, she has been burnt by a real fire once before, so play fire is good.
So what about when there aren't fake fires to roast marshmallows on at the Botanic Gardens, or cubbies to build in East Brunswick? How can parents incorporate nature into kids' lives naturally? Cecile has some ideas.
Well, I would definitely say visit some of your amazing local parks, because they are they're beautiful. For instance, here in Melbourne, you have the Royal Botanic Gardens, and the Children's Garden in particular is a real gem for kids. And just going to a park with a couple of families and letting the kids play and explore that area, well, you're at a safe distance, but you let them explore, and then maybe you help a little bit with what they see later on, or you ask them to show you what they see. Those are just really simple things.
So I guess we've been focusing on the commercialisation of play as it applies to kids. Kids are spending less time in nature, kids are playing less, kids are having less adventures. But maybe it's a problem that goes further than that. Maybe it's a problem for adults too. Cecile says nature play doesn't have an age limit, and I'm inclined to agree. Spending time in nature is important as a child because of the habit and connections it creates. But all of that's pretty useless if we start shutting ourselves indoors when we reach adulthood, stop playing in rock pools and climbing trees.
For people who are so busy all the time and, trying to fit everything into the day, work and other things and school, and it's sometimes just really nice to step outside and look at the sky, or in the evening at the stars, or when you're on the water or near a river, look at the water surface and the reflections, or the ocean waves. That sort of time is invaluable to reconnect yourself with your environment and sort of where you are and how you feel. I don't think we do that enough, and I think kids get the opportunity to have that, you have active time in nature, but you can also have reflective time in nature, and I think it's really all really important. and as parents, we can have our own nature play, every day. As adults, I don't think we get enough time to do that, and I think it's really essential for feeling good about being alive, and so it's much bigger than just for children. I think it's a thing for everybody, really.
That story was produced by Jess O'Callaghan, with reporting by Emma Kewen and Carly-Anne Keneally. Thanks to the crew from Nature Play Week, the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, and Ceres Community Environment Park for having us along. We make this show at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Emma Kewen, Bethany Atkinson-Quinton, and Carly-Anne Keneally. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. My co-host is Michael Bryden, and I'm Pip Rasmussen. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.